Good morning, Your Honor. I'd like to reserve 2 minutes.
Thank you.
Apologize for the cold as well. It's going around. My name is Martin Burns. I represent the appellant in this case. This is action out of Pierce County Superior Court where there was a writless eviction that had been ordered by a judge, and that has been illegal in the state of Washington for over 100 years. We have a situation where we never had a trial. There's no findings of facts or conclusions of law. I look at this much in the way of a summary judgment, in that the case should be remanded back down for a trial on this. There is obvious issues of fact in this case. We have the bank's vice president, the respondent's officer, has contradicted her testimony as to who the purchaser was at the trustee sale. In the complaint and in her first declaration, they say Home Street Bank was the purchaser at a trustee sale. We pointed out that the trustee's deed says that's not the case. It was Union Street, which is their subsidiary holding company. They then file, without any explanation, another declaration that completely changes that testimony. And then we point out at that point in time that they aren't the purchaser at the trustee sale. And to invoke RCW 5912 under RCW 6124060, you have to be the purchaser at the trustee sale. They say, well, no, we have an assignment of those rights. But the assignment came after the trustee sale. The trustee sale was on January 16th, 2015. The assignment is notarized on January 21st, 2016.
But the assignment's dated January 8th.
Yes, but I cite in my brief how an assignment of an interest in land, a deed of trust, is an interest in land, and to be valid, it must be executed and delivered. You don't get to backdate those. And therefore, the law is pretty clear. You have to have execution and delivery for it to be valid. And
what did the trial court hold on that issue?
The trial court didn't hold anything. We didn't have a trial on it.
What was the issue presented? I mean, did you make that argument to the court?
I made the argument in a motion for reconsideration, which was denied. I was told to show up for trial on March 26th. I showed up for trial. They asked if possession was still an issue. I said yes, and then they didn't give me a trial. They converted it over our objection to a normal civil case. If I had then made counterclaims, I would have waived the issue of possession. We were forced to continue under the rules, under Munden versus Hazelrig and the Angelo case, that you have to maintain the right to possession, which we have done. I would tell the court that there's a very similar case that says that an assignee cannot ascend to the statutory rights, such as the right to, if you have to be a purchaser at the trustee sale to invoke the unlawful detainer section. And that's the Schultz versus, I'll screw up this name, but I think it's like Where Luis. And that case specifically says in it that, because they were saying, well, we took a contractual assignment, and therefore we have all their rights. And the court said that principle doesn't help. For the right to commence an action to set aside a forfeiture is conferred by statute, not contract. Had the legislature intended to extend standing to assignees of assignments recorded after the notice of intent to forfeit, the Forfeiture Act would have said so. If the legislature wanted assignees to be able to step in and do an eviction after a trustee sale, it would have said so. But the plain language of the statute says only the purchaser at a trustee sale, and it says it over and over again. And the standard notions of construction are that when a statute is clear, we don't add words to it. So that's only one of the issues. I mean, the whole notion, as prior counsel to me, went in and asked to extend the occupancy, which the commissioner in this case should never have done in the first place. The commissioner bound the matter over for trial properly because there's factual issues. But then he conditioned that right on making two payments of rent of $22,000 a month in February and then in March. That raises another issue because the bank accepted, or the respondents accepted, the rent.
It was your client, though, who asked the court to extend the occupancy. Isn't that correct?
Well, true, but we were put in a bad situation. The court should never have done that in the first place. The court should have just said, if there's factual issues for trial, have a trial. I mean, it would be like that.
Aren't you in kind of a bad situation, though, arguing that, you know, you were prejudiced by something that the court did that you yourself asked them to do? Isn't that inviting error?
I don't think we asked the court to put the $22,000 requirement down there, and the court could have required that potentially to be put into the registry of the court. I don't think that would be proper. I mean, imagine in a summary judgment situation where court says, well, I'm finding factual issues, I'll bind it over for trial if you deposit $100,000. You don't condition a trial on payment. If there's factual issues, there's factual issues, and you determine possession at the time of trial, which we never got, which is a statutory right under RCW 5912.
But Charity's asked the court to use its equitable powers.
No, not necessarily. No, we went in at the show cause hearing. We defended it. In fact, the show cause hearing was set at a time prior to our answer being due. It was not until after when the answer came in that the only part that we put in, which never got tried, was the notion of equitable estoppel. That portion has never been tried, but that's a defense to this, because what happened with the equitable estoppel is, going back factually, the bank consented to a change in the lease so that Charities would be the tenant, and they accepted rent thereunder. Then they foreclosed without providing notice, and then continued to accept rent from them. So they should be stopped from denying that the lease existed. But, I mean, that's not even half of the problems in this case. But the whole notion of the writless eviction, I mean, I don't think, when we don't have a situation where there's findings of facts and we don't have a situation where there was a trial, I don't think that it's proper for the court to prejudge what a trial may do. I think what's proper is the court to say, you're entitled to a trial, go have a trial. But the idea that a court, in a one-line order, when that issue wasn't even placed before the court in that motion, they just write, the defendant shall vacate on March 7th. And then what happened is on 10:30 on March 6th, the bank shows up with a security officer to change locks. We have a person there that says, well, there's no writ. And they call the Tacoma Police Department. Tacoma Police Department then chases our people off, threatening them with trespass. Now, this has not been legal in Washington for ages. Now, it's obviously wrong. It's patently wrong.
What do you think is the controlling authority case law?
On
writless
eviction?
Writless eviction is not possible.
Well, okay. I've got...
It's one case, whatever you think the leading case is.
Well, I've got it in my brief here. Well, I mean, I cite in my brief how it is the exclusive remedy. Using the writ process is the exclusive remedy, and I'm trying to find it right here. And I have a cite to a case and the Washington practice on this. One of the cases is Nelson versus Swanson, 177 Washington 187, which says the rule which made the landlord a law unto himself has been supplanted by a statutory speedy, adequate, and orderly, and this remedy is exclusive. That's on page 14 of my reply.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors. Thank you. My name is Elizabeth Hebner-Norwood. I'm the attorney for the respondent, Union Street Holding. From our perspective, this is more a case about a non-judicial foreclosure wherein the foreclosure was properly commenced and executed, and the occupant whose right had been extinguished did not properly vacate as they're required to do under the statute. As a preliminary matter, as the record reflects from the supplemental documentation that was authorized to be included in the record after our motion to supplement, Charities has made clear that their position is that they should be placed back in possession of the premises, that this court should reverse, they should be placed back in possession of the premises, and then the trial court should go back and, at that point, I'm actually not entirely clear what their requested relief is, whether it's to entirely dismiss the unlawful detainer case or whether it's to retry and litigate under the unlawful detainer. But under either circumstance, we don't agree with their position. But the requested relief is simply not possible. The property that was purchased at the trustee sale in January of 2015 was thereafter, once the occupant was removed, it was marketed and it was sold. Union Street Holdings has no further right, title, and interest in the property. Home Street Bank has no further right, title, and interest in the property. The parties to this lawsuit have no ability to put them in possession of the premises. So for that reason, the requested relief is simply impossible. Further, this court should affirm the trial court's rulings and the issues that Charities takes are just simply unavailing. They make essentially two arguments. One is to attack the sale itself, and the other is to attack the unlawful detainer action. While counsel's focused on the unlawful detainer action, I'd first like to address the non-judicial foreclosure. The foreclosure itself was properly conducted. There's no allegation, and there's nothing in the record that would indicate that it was not. The statute was followed. RCW 61.24.040, subsection 7, indicates that once a sale occurs and all of the time frames are met, the trustee's deed and the recitals that are in that trustee's deed are prima facie evidence of a properly conducted sale. That's what occurred here. The trustee's deed was issued by the trustee, and this action followed. The issuance of that trustee's deed after the sale and the execution of the sale terminated Charity's right to possession of the premises. The fact that then further proceedings were required to have them removed does not change that basic fact. Title transferred to the purchaser, who was Union Street Holdings, and Union Street was entitled to possession of the premises 20 days after the sale.
What about the argument that that you have conflicting declarations from the bank MP on who purchased?
I disagree with the conflicting declaration portion of it. I think that it was inartful, and that's unfortunate. But in the pleadings that were initially submitted, Union Street Holdings has been the plaintiff the entire time. That's obvious. And so they're the ones moving with the interest in the real property. The complaint in the original declaration indicated, reference Home Street Bank, which, as you know from the briefings, Union Street Holdings is a wholly owned subsidiary of Union Street Bank. Union Street Bank officers are primarily all Home Street officers, as is the officer who submitted the declaration. She's an officer of both Union Street and Home Street. The saying that the bank purchased the property in pleadings does not change the legal significance of what actually occurred, which is that Union Street Holdings purchased the property at the trustee sale, pursuant to their right to do so under the assignment, which had been agreed upon and executed on January 8th prior to the sale, and then actually those documents were then recorded thereafter along with the trustee's deed.
She says the bank, and I see that, but the immediately preceding paragraph, she only discusses Home Street Bank, and then states that authorized the bank to proceed with the foreclosure. There's no discussion of Union Street.
And as I said, that is certainly an inartful way that it was not made expressly clear the timeline on which the rights and interests were transferred. And so there should have been an intervening paragraph there that indicated that Union Street was assigned all right, title, and interest to the loan, underlying loan documents prior to the sale. And so I believe that the following declarations and the following pleadings indicate, again, that it was an unfortunate and inartful reference to the bank as opposed to specifically noting, here's Home Street, here's Union Street, here's who took the trustee's deed. What is evidence for purposes of, and what the trial court was able to rely upon, was the trustee's deed in the name of Union Street as the purchaser at the trustee sale.
Is this a case, is your argument like relying on the principle of Pline versus Lackey, I think is the name of the case that says that if you're going to challenge a foreclosure sale, you got to do it before the sale?
You know, I believe that it would be an applicable point of law, but we're not 100% relying on that because Charities has no interest in the foreclosure sale. Charities had no right to the deed of trust. They had no right to the underlying loan documents. They were an occupant who held pursuant to the borrower under the deed of trust. And so they didn't necessarily even have a right to challenge the foreclosure sale. The entire purpose of the Deed of Trust Act is there's the three principles, one of which is to to allow those who have an interest in preventing a wrongful foreclosure enough time and notice to prevent that foreclosure. This was not a wrongful foreclosure. There's no doubt that the debtor owed the funds and was no longer entitled to proceed with ownership, and so that's why the non-judicial foreclosure action was initiated. Everyone who was entitled to notice was given notice, and Charities wasn't entitled to notice, but it's also very clear that they did have notice that this was going on. So if they believed that they had some equitable right, title, and interest to the property, the fact that they waited until well after the unlawful detainer action was not only initiated but underway and orders had been issued saying that they had to be out by the 7th, they did waive their right to challenge this trustee sale to the extent they ever had one, which I would argue they didn't really have a right to challenge a trustee sale.
Do you agree with, or what is your position on counsel's argument that writless evictions are impermissible?
I would disagree with the position. I believe that I do agree with the underlying case law, which indicates that a landlord may not utilize self-help evictions. And the case law which sets forth that proposition are situations in which a landlord has a defaulting tenant and fails to get rent, has the tenant in non-compliance for whatever reason, goes in and changes the locks on their own before anything happens. That would be a wrongful self-help eviction. I would agree with that. This is A, not a landlord-tenant relationship, and B, this was not a self-help eviction by any means. This was an unlawful detainer action that had been properly instituted pursuant to the statute. Both RCW 64.21060 for authorizing a purchaser to initiate an unlawful detainer action, and RCW 59.12032, which authorizes the initiation of an action for unlawful detainer following a trustee sale, which I would note the language of that is quite broad in that it indicates that the unlawful detainer action is authorized following a trustee sale under the unlawful detainer statute. It's not, and I will get to your question, it's not as counsel notes in the that real estate foreclosure or real estate forfeiture statute. That statute in the Schultz case specifically addressed a statute that says only those people who are entitled to XYZ may pursue under this statute. This situation is different. The statutes, both RCW, both 6124 or 21 and 5912, are considerably more broad. There's no only limitation to it. But going back to the eviction, is that this was an order to vacate from a superior court. It was a valid order that told the defendant what they were required to do, and they didn't comply with it. I don't agree that a writ is a necessary, exclusive remedy and mechanism by which either a landlord or, in this case, not a landlord, but the owner of the real property who's seeking to take it back, or take possession of it following a trustee sale, I believe that they're entitled to rely upon an order of the court that plainly says, first, the original order that said that their occupancy had been extended only to March 7th in the equitable.
Well, I think I heard counsel argue that there's case law or something that he cited that says that it's an exclusive remedy. Or is that only referring to the unlawful detainer procedure itself?
I believe the unlawful detainer is the exclusive remedy, and that's what we're in. We're in unlawful detainer. Under 5912090, it's the statute which authorizes a writ of restitution specifically indicates that a plaintiff may seek a writ to obtain possession. It does not say they shall. Once a writ is issued, there are shall portions of how they must be executed, but it does not say that a writ shall be issued in order to gain possession. So we would rely upon the order of the court indicating that they were required to vacate, and we would ask the court to affirm the trial court's ruling.
Thank you.
I'd like to point out that it's clear law now in Washington that only a properly conducted trustee sale terminates the right of possession. That's the Albice case. And this was not properly conducted. We've already established that the Union Street did not obtain their rights until 5 days after the trustee sale, yet they credit bid at the trustee sale. That's not proper. Only the beneficiary of the note and the deed of trust can credit bid at the time of the sale. RCW 6124060 subsection 7 says that if you bid at a trustee sale and you're not the beneficiary, you must pay the money forthwith. That never happened. This was not a proper trustee sale. As to the issue of mootness, I've cited several cases, and this was an issue that came up in the motion on the merits, and there's more authority in the motion on the merits, that if the issue of possession remains, even if we're out of possession, that determination must be made by the court. And I can cite you some cases, but it is in that material that I've provided.
What about the counsel's argument that it's just not possible at this point?
Well, I don't think it's up for this court to determine, because I could see we haven't had any discovery on this. We don't know if this is an affiliated entity. We do not know if this was a non-bona fide purchaser, such as a situation in Albice, although that's a little different being a trustee sale. And the fact is that they may simply be, we may have paramount rights. There's a lot of legal briefing that would be required. Since we had paramount rights before, they may have a perfectly good deed claim against Union Street. As to the issue of inartful drafting, the complaint says Homestead. I mean, they said it was Homestead Bank. The point of Schultz is that you do not accede to statutory rights by a contractual assignment. And both the Landlord-Tenant Act and this utilize 5912, and the only remedy is a writ. I'd ask that you reverse and remand. Thank you.